Now, initially, I'd asked General if he could talk to us a little bit about the Middle East situation between Iran and Israel, because it's very, there's a powder keg over there, and we want to make sure that we keep an eye on situations and have a lot of different viewpoints on things, and we respect the general's viewpoint. He has the credentials to back up everything that he's saying and he's going to say today. So, if you don't mind, General, I could give you a bio and do all that for you, but I mean, why don't you just go ahead and tell us a little bit about who you are? And of course, you're with you're representing the Gold Institute as well. So we appreciate the Gold Institute for having you here. But thank you so much for joining us, sir. Give us a little intro, and then we'll just kind of kick into it.
Hey Brett, can you hear me?
Yes, sir, loud and clear.
Yeah, well, I'm just a harmless little fuzzball, just a soldier, and retired now, and I'm blessed to be able to work with another soldier, Green Beret, now Congressman Michael Waltz from the Freedom State of Florida, Florida's 6th District.
Fantastic. That's great. That's great. Yeah, I think I back channeled you about that. We'll maybe have to talk to him about some of the things that are going down there in Florida. Florida seems to be inching ever closer to the People's Republic of Florida with some of the things that they seem to be putting in. So we'll maybe hold his feet to the fire on that one if he'll give us the chance. But yeah, we would like to get your opinion on some of the stuff that's going on, especially in Iran and Israel and the tensions that continue to escalate between them. And then, of course, we add Syria into the mix, and we have just this, like I said, a powder keg that seems to be waiting. I'm wondering if you can try to help us get a handle on that situation, and as far as any sort of conflicts that are going on with them, but also this reports of the nuclear capabilities of Iran and how that has come, because we've been hearing that for 20 years, you know. So, you can get talk on any of those topics if you don't
Yeah,
mind.
well, I mean, I think I'd start by saying, geostrategics matter. We tend to think, war and great power competition is something of the past. We tend to think it's something it's not. But the reality is geostrategics matter. And Tehran knows this as well as anybody. And while we are busy tilting at other windmills, Tehran has been very busy since our incredibly irrational withdrawal from Iraq under the Obama administration in 2011. Overnight, Iran emerged as the dominant power in the Gulf, period, exclamation point. They have since gone on to co-opt more than 60% of Iraq. They essentially control through various proxies all of Iraq's ministries. They're in position now to throttle the only bright spot in that area, which is the Kurdistan region of Iraq. Everything that we had hoped for Iraq really is resident there in the Kurdish region in the north, and yet Tehran is doing everything it can to choke that off. Tehran has. Well, let's just say General Soleimani in 2016 or so, maybe 2017, boasted that the Iraqi army is now a Hezbollah army. Yeah, that's a remarkable statement. I mean, it's overwhelmingly full of Shia proxies, but also on top of it, by a remarkable parliamentary action in and around 2016, the Iraqi parliament formally incorporated the 110,000 men under arms, Shia men under arms, the Iranian proxies, the Hashd al-Shaabi, the PMU that had been cadreed, supported, trained, and led by various elements of the Quds forces under General Qasem Soleimani. They are now formally incorporated as part of the Iraqi security forces. This is incredible. This is absolutely incredible. So we know for a fact, and I've written at least one article on this over the last few years, we know for a fact that any of the Iraqi or now it's called counter-ISIS train and equip funds that we send to Baghdad, we know it is going into the hands of our enemy. It's incredible, but it's true. But it doesn't stop there. Iran has been very, very diligent about extending and projecting its power all the way to the shores of the Mediterranean. We've heard talk about this land bridge. Well, it actually exists, okay? It now races across largely the Shia areas of Iraq, through largely the Shia areas of Syria, all the way to the shores of the eastern Mediterranean and to the borders of its Hezbollah allies in Lebanon. This is absolutely remarkable. For the first time since the Persian Empire, let's say 400 BC, for the first time since the days of the Persian Empire, Tehran has meaningful military presence on the shores of the Mediterranean. Oh, and by the way, it doesn't stop there. Because just recently, I would say within the last year or so, Tehran has now inked a lease. They signed a lease to open a port, actually a naval base, on the shores of the eastern Mediterranean, on the Syrian shoreline, just near, I think it's just south of the Russian base at Tartus, which incidentally, in 2016, during the Obama administration, benefited from the establishment to its north of a Russian air base, to which Moscow deployed S-400 missiles, which extend 250 miles out into the eastern Mediterranean. That is an A-280 anti-access area denial bubble. There are only two other such bubbles on the NATO perimeter, and those are both up around the Scandinavian countries. So this is an incredible development. The Mediterranean is essential to, and it's always been considered the foundation to the security of Europe and through that the United States. It's just that important. It's probably more important today than before for various reasons that I don't need to get into right now. But it gets even better because Iran is also trying to establish a naval base, and it's got a significant presence off of Yemen. So through the Suez Canal transits, I think it's like 33% of the daily global transit of petroleum. So you've got Iranian presence there to the south. You've got Iranian presence in the Mediterranean now, and you've got a Russian ally of Iran that's openly operating inside Syria. None of this is good for Israel. Not a one of it.
And it doesn't seem to be good for the alliances that we have and the alliances that seem to be forming between Russia and Iran. And when you spoke about their incursion into that area of the Mediterranean, it only made me think about those connections between Russia and Iran. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to that, and possibly if we can even throw in China into that mix, too, and how that's going to tip the scales.
Yeah, well, let me try it. Try it like this. So in 1972 or so, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat woke up one day and he picked up the phone and he called his associates in Moscow, and Brezhnev and Kosygin, and he said, you know, hey guys, you know, all these 15,000 Soviet advisors you have here in Egypt, I want them out. And, you know, Sadat wasn't done because the Moscow-Cairo Friendship Treaty, he tore that up a couple years later. And then, of course, Camp David Accords followed after that. So practically overnight, the Soviets experienced a strategic reversal in the Middle East. And they've been trying to get back in for 45 years plus. Well, when we withdrew our combat power out of Iraq in 2011, we gave them the silver platter. Practically overnight, the Soviets, the Russians now, ramped up their presence in Syria. And of course, with the partnership, if not alliance, of Tehran. And they have now, all of them, projected their power into the eastern Mediterranean, to the north of Israel. Now, let me... This is very germane to Israel. I would suggest that the Mediterranean is of even more significance today than it was during and immediately after the days of World War II. In World War II, we didn't have the fiber optic, the critical fiber optic undersea cables that we do today. We didn't have Russian atomic submarines willing to operate there. We didn't have the greatest, I'm pretty sure these are the greatest reserves of natural gas discovered. Yeah, so off the coast of Israel is the Leviathan gas field. Off the coast of Egypt is this even larger, massive Zohr field. And off the coast of Cyprus is the Aphrodite field. These are huge, huge fields of gas. And by the way, they are geographically positioned to help Europe divorce itself, diversify away from its critical dependence on Russian energy. Let me say a little bit about this. Moscow has been very, very, very diligent over the last 20, 30 years, sinking its energy hooks deeper and deeper into Central Europe. The Europeans could only get so bold when they were tethered to this Russian energy lever. Let's just run through some of the numbers. Brussels was importing, I don't know, 30, 35% of their oil and gas. Germany was basically in that zone. And then it started to go up higher and higher until you get into the Scandinavian countries, 90, 95%. Even our NATO southern border, Turkey, right? Turkey, it sits strategically on the Bosporus and the Dardanelles, right? Even Ankara imports 35%, or did 35% of its annual oil and 60% of its natural gas from Moscow. Can you imagine that? Nobody under that circumstance can get too bold because Moscow, as they've done in the past, can remind everyone it could become a very cold winter. And did that to Georgia, for example. So in either case, these are some of the levers that Moscow had on Europe. And so that is all of great significance to a country like Israel, which sits on the Mediterranean, which sits on these massive gas fields. And, you know, this is not just about access to energy. It's really the economies that depend on this energy, you know, our ways, you know, our allies' way of life. So that's just at the core of it. Now, Israel, of course, is very concerned about the Iranian footprint, Russian ally, Iranian footprint along its perimeter. I was in Israel, I don't know, several months ago, maybe, yeah, it was last year. I think probably, I think I was there maybe in June, May, I don't recall now, but I was there and I got up to, the Lebanese border, and we actually got down into tunnels that had been captured by the IDF. These are Hezbollah tunnels underneath the border area. We got up into the Golan Heights. We got onto over by Jordan. We could see literally, you know, along the Syrian border. We could literally see encampments or just positions of IRGC and families. You can see Shia mosques on the other side of the border. And these IRGC members are not moving there for student exchange programs.
Well, it appears that Israel is being put into a position where they're being squeezed and they're going to be forced to act in some form or fashion. And we're just hoping that that does any sort of action by anybody doesn't lead to an escalation in military activity. But what do you think? What are your thoughts on what Israel's next moves may be on having to deal with all these situations that they're being faced with from all sides, it seems?
Yeah, well, you know, you don't deter war. I mean, we all want to deter war. None of us, no sane person desires war. I certainly don't. But you don't deter war by showing weakness, okay? You don't deter war by hamstringing yourself. You know, you deter war by showing that you are willing and capable of inflicting overwhelming combat power onto the enemy. And we have every nation has four elements of national power: diplomatic power, informational power, economic power, and of course, military power. And I like to tell my friends in the State Department, hey, diplomacy without credible military capability is fantasy. So Israel has been very diligent about presenting their military capabilities. And they are a country that really lacks strategic depth. I mean, aircraft, fighters from Syria could be over Tel Aviv in a matter of minutes. It's not a lot of reaction time.
Well, in fact, one of the things that you just brought up, too, is something that I wanted to ask you about, because I saw a report that, 37 out of the 40 reserve pilots for the Israeli army protested against fighting. I don't know if you'd heard about that or if that's something.
Yeah, I saw the headline. I didn't open it up, so I can't really comment on the specifics, but that's very curious to me.
From our perspective, when we looked at it, of course, I'll just read it off real quick. It says nearly all the reserve pilots, 37 out of 40 of the Israeli Air Force's sole heavy strike F-15 squadron, have informed their commander that instead of showing up for reserve duty, they'll be protesting against the government. And Patrick and I were talking about that earlier, and it just seemed like there might have been something else to that. We're not sure why they would have protested against that, against the government in that fashion. So, but if you can't speak on it, then obviously you can't. But it seemed strange to me that was going to come up. And also wanted to ask, sir, as we get a little further in here, would you be okay to take a few of our questions from our very well informed audience at some point?
Yeah, sure, happy to.
Awesome. That's great. We really appreciate.
If I don't know the answer, I'll tell you.
Hey, yeah, for sure. Well, we appreciate humility here, of course, as well. So we appreciate you joining us. And just to remind everybody, we appreciate the general for joining us here on the AM Grind. We're happy to have Brigadier General Ernest Audino here, the senior military fellow at the Gold Institute for International Strategy, among many, many of his many accolades that he's had throughout his life. And we appreciate you taking the time to join us here on the AM Grind powered by American Mission. You know, we're a very new grassroots organization, and we have a big task ahead of us. But luckily, we've been finding through these Twitter spaces that we have a very, very well informed public that is yearning for freedom and information. And so we appreciate you, Lynn, your expertise to maybe clarify some of these situations. Patrick, my co-host, he's back in here. He had some things he had to take care of, but he may have had a couple of questions for you, and also just may want to say hello, General Patrick. Patrick, General.
Hey, good morning, sir. Thank you for joining us. So I'm in technology, and I have something we talk about a lot is the use of drones and versus human capital and military engagements. How effective do you, at what point, I guess, to defeat a country, you have to put boots on the ground at some point. I have technological concerns about quality of programmers because I manage a lot of programmers, but putting the firing responsibility in the hand of software. So just wondering if you can comment on how that plays into that big stick that we need to wield sometimes, and your thoughts in general.
Yeah. All right. So, you know, I've said before, missiles don't win wars. They can kill people and break stuff, which at rock bottom ultimately is how wars are waged. But the fact of the matter is, air assets of any sort are just supremely important. But in the end, they only set conditions on the ground. They don't control those conditions. So controlling the conditions on the ground require tough guys on the ground willing to shoot evil men in the face. And that's just basically how it is. It's been like that since Christ was a corporal, as many of us like to say. And that's a reality. And the more we pretend war fighting is a matter of pushing buttons and it's a technological pursuit almost exclusively, the more we're fooling ourselves.
You make a great point because the other thing that I worry about is there's a human element to all this, right? And if we when we pull ourselves out of society, as we've done so effectively the last 3 years, I also think it becomes a lot easier to maybe make the wrong decision, that wrong call. I mean, you almost have to be on the ground, right, to make the right call, even with those drones. You know, like from Las Vegas, that facility where they fly a lot of the drones out of, you know, they still need an order from the ground, or else, you know, they may target the wrong vehicle or make another mistake, right? So.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, 100,000% I agree with you. You know, this harkens back to McNamara's WizKids, you know? I mean, they it was almost like they had a 5,000-mile-long screwdriver and trying to tune a carburetor in Vietnam, right? I mean, no, we cannot presume that those sitting in Olympian ignorance in Washington, D.C., have better situational awareness than the guys on the ground, the guys in the dirt with dusty boots. I mean, I don't know how else to say that.
And that's reflective of so many other situations too. You know, it goes back to the thing we talk about here on America Mission, how we have people sitting in Washington making decisions for people who live, you know, who are just normal people who live in society. And to your point, those people who are on the ground are definitely the ones we should listen to. And also wanted to invite you back, General, on Fridays. If you ever have a chance to come back on our show on Fridays, we do a second half of the show is all military appreciation and veteran outreach. And we've gotten a lot of traction with that. And, you know, we use these spaces not only to inform, I make the analogy that we're not gatekeepers, that we're doormen here. We like to open the door and let the information pass through. And one of those things that we do as well in the spaces, we provide an area where it's kind of like a support group where we're all, you know, we want to get things going and find solutions to problems. We are action oriented. So you're definitely welcome to join anytime for that, to add to that, and also appreciate your service. And we have several servicemen who and women who join us on this show, and some great informed Americans. And I would like to maybe ask if they, unless you had another statement you want to make, I'd like to maybe bring them in to ask a few questions to you.
Yeah, sure. But one thing I would like to do is maybe we chat about China later on, too.
Oh, yes. That's a big one. Yeah, we can. We need to talk about the China-Taiwan situation. And yeah, anything. It's we'll open it up to international. Anybody else wants to bring anything else? We certainly can. You know, if we were talking about Iran, we could talk about the Iranian quote-unquote battleships that were off of Brazil. And we can talk about all sorts of BNR, Belt and Road Initiative things that are tearing us apart. So we appreciate that. So anybody else got a question? Let's go to Destiny first. And then we'll move on down the line. Destiny, what have you got for the general?
Thank you. I mean, I talked to, and I wish we had an Iranian or an Israeli in here. I talk multinationally through a couple of different platforms a lot. And when I speak to them, there seems, I wanted to ask the general, you know, there was the talk about the air pilot's refusal to go. Do you think that the situation between the Iranian and the Israelis is that due to land, water politics, and gas, or do you think it's possibly still due to they have kind of an argument over the land? Like the people in Israel that are Jewish believe that they, you know, they should have control over Israel, and then the Iranians, I think it's the Iranians, also have a claim that they're saying no, they don't, and they pushed us out, and there's huge amounts of fighting there, from what I understand, from what the people there, you know, when they speak to me, they.
So you're wondering whether it's a cultural issue or if it's a battle over resources? Is that correct?
Or is it over the religious aspect of it?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, since 1979, the so-called Islamic Revolution in Iran, when the Shah was overturned and the mullahs co-opted what was, which was fundamentally a secular revolution, but the mullah, the Ayatollah's thugs literally co-opted that and made it into an Islamic revolution. Since that day, it has been the sworn objective of Tehran to eliminate Israel.
That answered my question. Yeah, because I was that's what I was thinking. I was thinking it was more along the lines of, I mean, I guess in America it's kind of hard for us to understand, but this is more about ideology. The war over there, I think, is.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about
Western Hemisphere was a guy by the name of von Clausewitz. Brilliant guy. Absolutely brilliant guy. But, you know, Clausewitz observed that war, certainly in the Western tradition, was politics by extreme measure. You know, I mean, he observed that. And look at it here in the United States. Every single issue that crosses the floor of either chamber in our Congress or any of the legislatures across the United States, every issue that comes up for debate is a potential fight, but we don't fight about it. You know, we argue, we debate, and then ultimately we vote, and somebody wins and somebody goes away with hurt feelings. But at some point in the real world, and this is, you know, at some point elsewhere, the first bullet flies, right? And I wish God had given us more than two ways to resolve conflict. And Clausewitz puts it this way: it's the Clausewitzian dialectic. It's between pure reason on one hand, across a spectrum that is bounded by pure violence on the other hand. And at some point on that spectrum, we move from reason debate into the first bullet flies, and then we start trending towards war. But how does that? You know, there's some of us, and I know I'm in the minority, but there are some who really believe. How does that explain holy wars? How does that explain wars that are based on faith, right? I mean, you know, you would think in the Clausewitzian sense, in the Western tradition of war, there's a political issue in dispute that at some point one side says, you know what, it's not worth it anymore. I concede this political issue and the war ends, okay? But how do you concede your faith? You can't concede your faith, you know? It's waged on your basis, you know, your status. So to the Ayatollahs, this is a matter of faith. I don't know that they can be reasoned out of a position they never reasoned themselves into in the first instance. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. And I appreciate that. And thanks for the question, Destiny. That's definitely something, an issue that we need to sort of flesh out. And thanks for being, what was the dialectic again? One more time. I got to look that up.
It's the Clausewitzian dialectic. It goes from pure reason to pure violence. You know, Clausewitz in his masterpiece on war.
I love learning stuff every day. Thank you for that, General. I appreciate that. All right, Justice, let's get to you. What do we got for us?
It's an honor to talk to our general here. And how you doing, sir? How are you?
I'm fine. And by the way, generals are just like everybody else.
Yes, I know, sir, because I work with many of you guys. I work with four star generals. I work with Joseph Dunford and Scott Miller. With Scott Miller, Scotty Shorty Miller, whatever you call it, sir.
Yeah, Scotty Miller is a classmate of mine from West Point, and Joe Dunford and I served together on the joint staff. Wonderful guy.
I love the guy.
Superb guys, yeah.
Yeah, I love the guy. So my question is here that it was not our mistake that we invaded conventionally Iraq without knowing anything about it, and also the wrong politic decision making. We entered to Iraq and we made Iranian bolder there, and also we assisted fighting the ISIS against the Syrian government in there, and even ISIS is an evil people, and also we pulled out from Afghanistan and let the Taliban terrorists take over the entire country. And did we not make Iranian bolder, aggressive, and as a superpower entity in the region, which right now they opened the embassy of Taliban inside Tehran. So these are, I think, it's our mistakes. We made the Iraqian as the federalism government, we did a great job for that. But we did not did the same thing in Afghanistan. We could make in Afghanistan as a federal government too, and we could control and we stop the terrorists to get invade everything. So I think it was most of the war, and we made it Iranian greater there against the other countries in the region. We made it because of our fault decision-making, our pullout prematurely, and our retrograde prematurely from those countries around it. Iran had no guts even to move while we were in Afghanistan. They had not
Did you have a question for the general?
Yeah, that was my question. Did we did it or not? It was our problem, or we prematurely pulled out that caused the Iran an aggressive or not?
Iran is emboldened by some of our decisions. The decision to invade Iraq, I was in favor of, and I'm still in favor of that. The critical poor decision was withdrawing. That is what emboldened Tehran. And I'll say this: there was a point when Iran was literally surrounded by U.S. military might, 150,000 in Iraq plus another 100,000 in Afghanistan. And plus our sanctions were having effect at the time. Plus there were years of violent student demonstrations inside Iran that were not getting covered in the Western press. If there was any time for us to hamstring, to push for some type of nuclear deal, it's when we had our foot on their throat. And Tehran wanted nothing more than U.S. forces to withdraw from around its perimeter. And guess what we did? Guess what the Obama administration just gave it all to them. Obama gave it to them and asked for nothing, and then tried to pursue a nuclear deal. This is insane. This is not how you negotiate in the real world. And then Joe Biden, this administration, irrationally withdraws from Kabul, from Afghanistan. We had an airbase at Bagram that literally was of immense strategic significance vis-a-vis China and others. And we just gave that up.
This seems to be reminiscent of the Bush 1 administration in the 90s, having their ability to essentially squash the CCP out of existence after all of the things that happened with Tiananmen Square and the fall and the change in leadership and then the fall of the Soviet Union. It just reminds me of that. We had the opportunity to take care of Iran and we didn't. We had the opportunity to take this care of the CCP and we didn't. And the CCP has now grown into something that is definitely something that we all need to pay close attention to, not just geopolitically, but also economically. All this trade talk, getting rid of the petrodollar and all these things. Maybe actually we can start leading into talking about China and the CCP a little bit, because that is a huge issue, and I harp on that all the time. And I just also, while we're coming up here on the half hour here, I want to remind everybody that you have the power in your hands to make this show grow. It is you that can push the retweet button and put this out so we can get as many people in here to spread this information. Each and every one of you that's in here, I appreciate every single one of you. Instead of listening to the top 40 hits of the crazy, wacky morning guy and K-Rock, you decided to come here and learn some stuff about the world and things that you can do, because we aren't at American Mission are not just here to echo chamber and bitch about things. We are an action oriented organization. So we appreciate everyone here joining us, and please tweet us out. And if you have questions for the general, please raise your hand and we're going to try our best to get every single one of them. But General, maybe we could sort of transition, unless you had something else you wanted to add, a follow up point to what you were just talking about, to maybe transition to the CCP. We talk a lot about BRICS here. We talk about a lot of the strategic moves that they're going, the red lines with Taiwan, all sorts of stuff. It's pretty much wherever you'd like to start, where we could go from there.
Here's where I would like to start. I think we've got a great misconception, and we have to see reality for what it is and not for what we'd like it to be, or what we think it is. We have to see it clearly. And here's the thing. We've long been I mean, how many of us don't believe that China is this economic powerhouse? I mean, look at the Winter Olympics a few years ago, the opening night in Beijing. You know, it was incredibly opulent. It was reported that Beijing spent like $1 billion on just that one opening night. I can remember the discussions after that. People here were shaking their heads like, we could never do that. It was incredible. But here's the reality about China's wealth and its economy. 80% of China's wealth is concentrated in a belt that's roughly 100 kilometers wide that runs along the Pacific Rim. Those are the trading communities. And it's absolutely opulent. There's plenty of wealth there. But guess what? China, a country of 1.3 billion people, 80%, ironically, of the rest of the country subsists on a per capita annual income of $3,600. These are poverty levels. Nearly 1 billion Chinese still live in impoverished condition. These are the untrained masses. The middle class in China is only about 5% of the Chinese population. A healthy middle class, a large middle class, is always an indicator of a strong and stable economy, but not so in China. And this is why China fears nothing more than its trade with the West. That is China's strategic vulnerability. And although I'm not necessarily advocating this, there isn't a single boat that floats in the Pacific that doesn't float without at least a tacit acquiescence of the United States. I mean, if we really, really, really wanted to, we could start putting boats to the bottom of the drink. I mean, I'm not advocating that, of course. But that's the situation that China is in. It has to import massive amounts of food and grain. It has to import massive amounts of oil. It has to. And China, geographically, is almost like an island because it's got the long Pacific coastline, and then it's surrounded by desert and almost impassable mountains around the rest of its perimeter. So geostrategically, it's in a tough situation. And I'll go on to say this. Beijing is fearful of this kind of thing. When Beijing opened up to Western trade in the middle of the 19th century, like the British did it in the 1840s or so, right? China has seen this sort of tension between openness to trade and internal instability. It's just kind of what happens. And Mao comes along and imposes the Cultural Revolution to shut down all of this Western liberalism, and it crushed the Chinese economy again. It crushed it. All right. We're seeing a similar fear inside China these days. And the result is going to be increasing internal repression and control. Look at the technology that China is using now to control its population. It's increasing exponentially all the time. So there's a guy that I think is worth reading up on. His name is Wang Huning. And he really is probably the top ideological inspiration behind much of what we're seeing out of Xi Jinping these days. He's a quiet guy. He's relatively young. But unlike everybody else, the other political leaders inside China, this guy has lasted through three premiers, presidents in China, without being killed or jailed or tossed to the side. This is how influential the guy is. And here's the thing. He came to the United States, I think, I don't know, late 80s, early 90s or so. And he studied here for about 6 months. And he wrote a book on that, America Against America. And he saw the excesses of Western liberalism. He saw the homelessness, the drug use. And he was certain that the United States and its Western values was on the decline, that it was crushing itself. But the flip side is Beijing fears Western liberalism inside its own country again, like it did under Mao. You know, and look, it's, I mean, here's a perfect example. In 2021, the Chinese actress Zhao Wei, famous inside China, but she was obviously a kind of a signature Western sort of a personality. She disappeared. Not only did she disappear, all of her media accounts disappeared, and there's been a slate of these types of disappearances inside China. Beijing is trying to crush this insinuation, this inflow of Western influence, Western liberal thought. It feels that that is its threat, just as it did in the 19th century.
Well, and they feel that way from what I understand, because they their system that they're running on is essentially what would be maybe referred to the way I heard it referred to in a 2019 book that came out by Brigadier General Robert Spalding called Stealth War. Well, he described the Chinese Communist government as a paper tiger and as a gigantic Ponzi scheme, and that's one of the reasons why they try to purge themselves of any of these Western ideas, because they know it can be, once the information's out there, the people obviously may revolt. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I agree. So when the good communists in Beijing do what good communists always do, try to redistribute the wealth. Remember, there's this historic, unprecedented, gigantic, disproportionate distribution of wealth inside China, as I've just described. When they do what good communists do, redistribute wealth, impose the policies that try to redistribute this, that's when those Pacific Rim trading communities in that 100-kilometer wide belt, that's when they realize, you know, their continued good well-being depends more on healthy trade with the West than it does with the good communists in Beijing. This is the sort of social and political tension that Beijing has always feared. And this is why it is so right, and was so right under the Trump administration, to target the Chinese economy. Remember, I mentioned there are four elements of national power: diplomatic, informational, military, and economic. Sound grand strategy means you are optimizing the leverage that you enjoy or you have over those levers. And if we are not paying attention to the Chinese economic vulnerabilities, we are terrible grand strategists. And by the way, you know, speaking of grand strategy in the United States is like speaking of snakes in Ireland. I mean, I wish I could take credit for that statement, but I didn't come up with it. But that's the truth.
You're right.
We've lost good grand strategy.
You're right. And thank you all for joining here, the AM Grind. We're joined by our very special guest, Brigadier General Ernest Audino, from the Senior Military Fellows at the Gold Institute for International Strategy. We appreciate you joining us here. And as you can see, there are quite a lot of questions for you, sir. Your expertise is needed here. So if you don't mind, we do say the last 20 minutes is our lightning round. But of course, we do have our, you are our special guest, and we want to give you the floor as much as you would like to speak. But, I would like to maybe field a couple of questions from our audience members and everybody who's got their hands up. I know you want to make do your statements on that and everything else, but we're running out of time. So I was wondering if we could try to be as concise as possible. And I'm sorry, y'all do have your hands up, but I do have to defer to my co-host first because he gets preferential treatment. So let's Patrick, what do you got? And then we'll move on down.
No, it's on Xi Jinping, to your point about survival. He was actually a princeling back in the 70s and was persecuted. His family was persecuted when Mao went after some of the senior party folks during the Cultural Revolution. So that's something I'm surprised by, his movement towards that, in that direction. I think a lot of people are in China. Curious your thoughts on that. And secondly, it's about 100 miles from the coast of China, I think 160 kilometers, so roughly 100 miles to Taiwan. My gut tells me there's still a long time before China can launch an assault of the scale that would be required to take on Taiwan. And so curious on both those fronts. Yeah.
I mean, it's ironic that Xi, who experienced the repressions, Xi and his family experienced the repressions of the Cultural Revolution, are back contemplating actually employing the same things. And but it's because the reality is China has experienced this tension between openness and tension. I mean, internal instability. And Wang Huning, who I mentioned earlier, he's crafted a belief in a goal to meld a privatized Western type of economy, but with state control and adherence to Chinese traditions. This has never happened before. I think it's unlikely to happen now. And if we are a rational great power, we would exploit this vulnerability to reduce Chinese capabilities to project their power around the globe. But we're watching that happen. We're watching China try it out. But you know, there's also the reality that the Chinese investment in all these places around the globe. What happens when people, you know, default on those loans and China takes possession? I mean, they can't take these properties with them back to China. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we've got to stay resolute in opposing this creeping Chinese presence around the globe.
It just came out today that that Sri Lanka has defaulted on several of theirs, and that Chinese are willing to, quote, restructure with them. So yeah, that's these predatory loans are something also we try to bring up to our listeners as well. Elvin, thanks for sticking around. I appreciate you, my friend. What have you got for the general?
Good morning, General. I'm a former 18 Delta Special Forces medic and later a Cobra pilot, warrant officer.
Ooh. Nice.
Army strong. I have two questions for you. I'll make very quick. In 1989, I was involved in Operation Just Cause, which was in Panama to arrest and take Noriega. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand why we don't use that as the template for the U.S. military crossing the border against the Sinaloa and other cartels to stop that. I realize that the Posse Comitatus Act doesn't allow us to do anything on our side of the border unless an invasion is declared. But I it seems to me like we should have the absolute ability to do the same thing we did in Panama in 89. The second question is, you had a long history with the Peshmerga, actually embedded with them. And I'm wondering if you can basically tell us why it seems like we've abandoned the Kurds. Is it just because they include the PKK, or is it capitulating to Turkey, Iraq, and Syria, who are obviously do not want the Kurds to have a Kurdistan? Thank you.
Yeah, hey, those are great questions, and thanks for your service. Yeah. So let's take the cartels south of our border. Yeah, absolutely. I'm 100% in agreement with you. And you know, my boss is pushing for an authorization for the use of force against them. The answer why we're not is because of who we have in the White House right now. We have a group of people who are putting ideology and all right, I'll say it, personal interest ahead of vital national interest. You know, many of us have grown up in a world where we understood that the greatest meaning you can derive from life is by serving a purpose bigger than yourself, serving a higher purpose. That's what military service is all about, right? And you and I both know, for example, real leaders, you eat last, you sleep last. You know, if there's only, you know, if your team's short, some snivel gear, some ponchos, wet weather gear, well, guess what? You go without so your guys can have it. You know, you sleep in the rain, right? I mean, you know how it is. But it's fascinating and despicable to watch something 180 degrees different right now in Washington. But nevertheless, you know, there are some who are pushing for an authorization for the use of force, but it's going to have to get through, you know, the House and the Senate, and then it's going to have to get over to the White House where Joe Biden will certainly veto it.
You know? Yeah, and, let, and let's Yeah, agree. Yeah, I think he probably will too as well. I mean, didn't he make his pledge to veto everything as well? Yeah, and to your point about Mike Waltz, he also, yeah, I've seen him put forth several things that are in that direction. I'm intrigued to possibly be able to get in touch with him and talk to him some more about some issues. So that's definitely something we got to think about. Thank you very much, Elvin, for that question. Elvin always comes in with the fire.
And the current
can I add? Yeah, I want to, if I can, real quick, address the two other components of this. You know, you mentioned the Kurds, but he also mentioned Posse Comitatus on this side of the border. Don't be so sure that Posse Comitatus blocks all military response. So Posse Comitatus acts to bar federal military troops from enforcing the laws of the nation. It does not bar National Guard units operating under their commander-in-chief at the state level, meaning in state status. So every governor in this country is a commander-in-chief of his militia, his National Guard, which is based on our colonial militia experience. Our entire army is made up of 55 armies. People don't believe that. We've got a federal army, yeah, absolutely. But we have 54 others, the 50 states and territories. Okay? On a daily basis, their commander-in-chief is their governor. And it takes courageous governors to do it. I'd like to see a little more courage out of some of these governors. When their states are being invaded, right? This is an invasion.
Yeah, 100%. 100%, 100%, and yeah, Greg Abbott needs to get off his ass and do something. And you know, the lib, you know that Katie Hobbs isn't going to do anything, so we know that that's not going to happen. Yeah, let's keep it moving here. Patrick, did you see whose hand was next? I was it Marlon or was it Dave? I really don't want to step on anybody's toes, or maybe it was Brunella.
Our new listener,
Brunella,
and then we go Marlon, DJ, and Dale. I think
fantastic. All right, well, ladies first anyway, right? Brunella, what you got for us?
It's our day today, so you know, I should be so
there you go.
Yeah, sorry, because actually General, it's a pleasure to speak with you, and I've been myself traveling in many Middle East country and changed different countries. I was from the Gulf War on, so you know, I'm a person anyway that even if it didn't want to, I've been evacuated twice. So I know a little bit my chickens. Of course, I don't know, you know, as much, but let's see, I have some knowledge. I would like to talk with people like you, with a person that know so much and try to convince them what's going on. There is a big difference, I think, in our days. Like once there was a time that war happened when there was no more space for diplomacy, unfortunately. Nowadays, you probably agree that is not what it's happening anymore. Everything is changed in the last 30 years. Also, the use of army and the use and so on. This is also pretty shocking, because one of my terror and one of my question was exactly, what do you think if we are risking the use of unconventional weapons, since that I know that three of the biolabs that have been closed in Ukraine, they are open now in, for example, in Italy, and we don't have even the level 4 security. Only France and England have it. So we are a little bit terrorized about this. But on the other hand, I'm calling from Europe, so. You know, here we are a little bit devastated at the moment. I'm in Germany. I saw from your assignments that you actually had spent a few years here, so guten Abend. The point is that...
Yeah, and Brunella, did you have a question? Because we're kind of running out short on time here.
The question is this one. I wanted to ask about, what does he think about the use of unconventional weapons, and what does he think about the Nord Stream? Because for us was... it's important that from European citizens, people, especially in the US, know that for us was a big traitor action. We are terrorized because we didn't have any problem with US. We are allies. You know, we were actually thought that we were allies. And since the Nord Stream happened, I mean, I'm talking about the fact that I need to ask to my kids not to speak English in Berlin. When they go out now, they need to speak another language, but not English, because people watch you badly. So something really changed. So two things. Nord Stream, what is your opinion about this? Unfortunately, I call it the traitor action, but up to you what you think. And second, what is the real risk of the use of unconventional weapons in our days? Thank you.
So unconventional, you mean nuclear weapons?
Well, a little bit, you know, they are nuclear. Nuclear is a bit old-fashioned. Unfortunately, I think in our days, also because anyway, Russia have Sumat, and with the Sarmat, the Sarmat, I think, is something that can reach everywhere. So I don't know if US want to really reach that level of, you know, with, I mean, we know exactly.
Yeah, let's let the general speak to that.
Yeah, I'm talking about the, sorry, I just wanted to define the question. I'm talking about the biolabs, the viruses. I'm talking about the hypothetical use of AARM, you know what?
Nuclear, biological, yeah, and chemical weapons. You. Yes. Yeah. All right. So let me start with Nord Stream. I mean, I don't know what you refer to. What you refer to about the betrayal, but the reality is the Russians were very, very, very diligent about sinking its energy hooks into Europe through Nord Stream. Now, and the Europeans bought into that, with the exception of the French for the most part and the Italians for the most part. Now, why would that be? Because the French have a very well-developed nuclear industry. They just didn't need this amount of Russian energy, okay? Italy didn't need it either because of its historic reliance on and its relationship with Libyan oil, very nearby. And Libyan oil is some of the best, the lightest and sweetest in the world. It's superb oil. So Italy had less of a reliance on Russian energy as well. So, and even the European Union in 2014 published an energy independence strategy. I read the document. I read the whole thing. And it was purposed to help Europe diversify itself away from this critical dependence on Russian energy. But what did Europe do? Okay, not much more than build a whole bunch of windmills all across Europe. You can't drive through Europe now swinging a dead cat without hitting one of these windmills. And they haven't made a dent in the energy usage in Europe. What's going to alleviate that is, in my opinion, is access, ready access to alternate energy sources, such as from the Eastern Mediterranean, or even I've seen some studies from the United States. It looks like the studies that I saw, there are at least a few companies where it's economically tenable to transport liquid natural gas from the United States to Europe. So that's that situation.
This is going to cost us four times more than used to cost the normal gas that we had with Russia.
Maybe not. I don't know. Okay. But you know, you Europeans, if you got to make decisions, what's most important? I mean, a lot of things cost money. Everything has a cost. But anyway, in either case, well, you know, what's the likelihood of the use of nuclear, biological, or chemical weapons? Well, I think it's pretty much the same as it's been since the Cold War, with one exception, and that is with Russia. While the United States was unilaterally trying to set the example for disarmament, nuclear disarmament, by reducing its stockpile on the, you know, the belief, this almost religious belief that it would inspire others to downsize their stockpiles, we have seen just the opposite. We see a nuclear India, nuclear Pakistan, nuclear North Korea, nuclear China, a nuclearizing Iran. No, it's just the opposite. And oh, by the way, we unilaterally eliminated an entire class of weapons And those are TAC nukes. We no longer have any tactical nuclear weapons in the U.S. arsenal. But guess who has 5,000? Russia. Russia has 5,000 tactical nuclear weapons. And they have only one purpose. TAC nukes are for dominating and enabling land operations through Central Europe. That's what they're used for. So, you know, Europeans, you just gotta, you gotta see that. You gotta understand that.
Thanks, General. Yeah, it's a tough thing. I don't, you know, what I see this, I look at the likelihood of Russia using those. I don't think they'll go to unconventional weapons unless we're threatening their Crimea is a red line. If we're threatening their control of the Black Sea, then I think anything's possible. Would you agree, General? Or?
Well, I think what increases the likelihood, I'll say this, what increases the likelihood of the use of a nuclear weapon would be the demise or the serious reduction of conventional military capabilities. It makes the reach to a nuclear weapon that much shorter, right? So we can do a lot to understand capabilities and technology, but the hardest thing in the world is to understand what an enemy is likely to do, what a Putin is likely to do. We can presume that everybody is rational. But I don't know that that is really a valid assumption.
Well, and then provocation is also a big thing too, because you know, somebody can be completely rational, and then they could be provoked beyond where they have to act. And I think that we've touched on so many issues here, and I think it's quite clear that we haven't even scratched the surface of the things and the problems that we have, and the solutions that we can possibly put together to alleviate some of those issues. And I just want to take this second to thank you again, General, for joining us, and let you know that you are welcome back at any time, whether it's scheduled or not. If you want to jump in and request a mic, you will always, if you have any information to give our audience, you are definitely a friend to the AM Grind, and we appreciate everything that you've given us today. And once again, you're welcome back anytime. And thanks everybody else for listening. I'm so sorry that we didn't get to all the hands. I can keep my space open probably all day long if I wanted to, but I usually try to take our first commander in chief's advice on knowing when to walk away. And unfortunately, that is right at this time. So we are going to transition to the midday AM space with Trash Discourse and Jen Lawrence. If y'all want to go jump over there, if you aren't following either of them and you aren't able to find it, I'll jump over there with my on my Twitter page so that I can you'll be able to direct your way that way. General, again, thank you so much. We appreciate y'all. Check out all of his work and check out the Gold Institute as well. Plenty of great stuff coming out of there. And just want to remind everybody also to like and subscribe and share all of our stuff for America Mission. Vet us as we vet the elected officials that we need to change and put proper people in. So I really appreciate everybody, and have a great day. God bless you all, and God bless America.